putting others first. As I was, you know, doing that, I thought, you know, that's really the theme of the whole book of Corinthians, putting others first, or is a major theme of the whole book of Corinthians. That was the major problem in Corinth. They were not putting others first. And last week and this week, we're seeing two very specific examples of this major theme that what we have, we are to use to serve others, especially those in the church. And again, that shows up all throughout this book. You think we get to chapter 12, and Paul starts talking about their spiritual gifts and tells them that they're for the common good. In chapter 13, we get this beautiful chapter about love, and we read it at our weddings because it's the pinnacle of what love is supposed to be. But the reason Paul put it here in chapter 13 of Corinthians is because it was how they're supposed to treat each other in the church. And those things that we think of as, you know, what's supposed to be between a man and a woman at their marriage is really Paul's teaching on what it should be like for all of us in the church. However, the Corinthians seem to have turned, their main problem seems to be that they've kind of turned the commandments up on their head. If you think of the commandments being summarized as love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, the Corinthians' problem is that they love themselves to the exclusion of their neighbor and their Lord. You know, so they've just completely flipped it over. And so Paul, throughout the book, is having to constantly bring them back to this idea that what they have is for others. They are to think more highly of others than themselves. They're supposed to stay single if they can because they'll be better able to serve others. Not because being single is some great spiritual state that married life isn't. Paul's saying, if you have the gift of singleness, great, because you'll be better able to serve others. That's the whole point of the book, seems to be our ability to serve others. Levi was presenting chapter 9 to us last week, and about how Paul is just giving up one right after another in order that he might get the gospel out to as many people as possible. So again, not using what we have or what we deserve or who we are for ourselves, but using it for others. And I've already mentioned chapter 12 on our spiritual gifts or the common good. Chapter 13, love is patient and kind, not boasting, building others up. It does not insist on its own way. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And, you know, it's so easy to get to that one about hopes all things and just think, oh, you know, hope is about heaven, right? I have this hope that I will go to heaven. But in this context, it is hoping all things for you, right? I don't just go, pfft. You know, you're just so far gone, there is no coming back from being you. But to have hope that no matter how weak my brother in Christ is, that there is hope that they will grow, that they will change, that there will be a next level. It believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. I still have to put up with you, is the attitude. No, actually, that's the wrong attitude. It endures all things for the brethren. So are we seeing a theme here in Corinthians from the Apostle Paul? So he comes to the beginning here of chapter 8. And he brings up a particular issue. Now, this is clearly an issue that has been raised by the Corinthians. So let me just start here by reading the first couple of verses. Now, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge, and this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. Now, so we've come to one of the questions that the Corinthians have raised for Paul. Can meat be eaten that was sacrificed to idols in the pagan temples? Can we eat the meat that was sacrificed to idols in the pagan temples. And we're going to see two things we're going to get a little insight into the question and how they ask the question from the way Paul responds to the question. Sometimes we don't know exactly what the question is, but in this case, we're going to get some very clear insight into how they've asked the question. For them, this is not an academic question. You know, us elders particularly, but us Presbyterians in general, love to sit around and ask academic questions. You know, what about if such and such and so and so, and to wrestle down questions that really at the moment have no relevance in our lives. I won't bring up any of my picadillos that I love to talk about. But this is not an academic question for them. This is actually another cause for division within the church at Corinth. There is clearly a yes group and a no group that is in Corinth on this question. And it seems that the yes group is in the majority, or at least were the ones that were penning the question. It is the yes side that Paul addresses with his answer, not really the no side. And then we'll also see that the yes side had gone so far as to say that they were convinced that they could eat the meat, not just eat the meat, but eat the meat in the pagan temples at the pagan festivals. So that's where they were at. Paul's response to this is fascinating. So just hang on. First thing we see is that he quotes their argument. We know that all of us possess knowledge. So you see that the translators here for the ESV have put "all of us possess knowledge" in quotes. There are no quotes in the Greek. But most translators and most commentators believe, and I think they're right, that what Paul is doing here is quoting their argument. So concerning the food offered to idols, concerning this question that you have raised, we know, you said, and I am agreeing, we know that all of us possess knowledge. Then he wants to address the knowledge before he gets on to the question of eating the food. And he says this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So he's not here saying that, and he says, then if anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not know as he ought to know. Now, you could misinterpret this to say that Paul here is anti-intellectual. And I grew up with plenty of those types of Christians in Appalachia. Not in my particular church, but in that community, where they were dead set against having the preacher educated. Because, if a man went off to seminary and learned stuff, that would ruin him spiritually. You could see how this verse 2 and 3 could be misinterpreted that way. If anyone imagines he knows something, he does not know what he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. But the thing is, Paul's not teaching an anti-intellectualism here. Paul's a teacher. I mean, you can't read through the letters of Paul and not have this sense that he's wanting to communicate a large bulk of knowledge to the people. And there are several places in his letters where he says, "I pray continuously for you that you will grow in knowledge." So it's clear that Paul here is not talking in some sort of anti-intellectual way. He's praying, or he's challenging the Corinthians here, because they use their knowledge in the way that they're using everything that they have for self-centered aggrandizement. This is the knowledge that puffs up. So I know something, and I know I have mastered this subject, and all you peons just need to listen to me. That's what's going on in Corinth. A little convicting as I stand right here. Paul is saying that if your knowledge has led to pride and boasting and being puffed up, then you don't know what you ought to know. Because you'll often hear professors, and this is part of what worries those people in Appalachia, because you do see this in seminarians. The more you learn about the Bible, the more you realize you don't have it down. And there's nuances throughout the scriptures that take lifetimes to learn and that you still don't master. And it's so much easier to be dogmatic when you have a little knowledge than it is when you have a lot of knowledge. And so Paul is saying, if you think you've mastered the subject, you need to remind yourself that you have not mastered the subject. There is no mastering the subject of God. And so you need to be humble. Now, he's not saying, so just pretend like everybody's knowledge is at the same level. You know, because Paul clearly wants to teach and he wants people to grow. Paul's not going to say, yes. You know, if Paul walked up to me and we had this lengthy conversation, he'd say, you know, Rick, you and I are just basically the same. He'd say, Rick, I love you. You got a long way to go. Right? It's not that he doesn't distinguish between types of knowledge or levels of knowledge. He wants us to grow in knowledge. He knows that some people know more than other people. Only a few are called to teach, according to Paul. But when you get to the point where you are using that knowledge to lord it over others or to think more highly of yourself, then you have missed the boat. You really don't know as you ought to know. You need to keep reminding yourself that all spiritual knowledge is a gift of the Holy Spirit, that you can't figure this out on your own. And even if you have reached a level higher than someone else, even that's a gift. And so you should do what Paul does, which is pray that everyone would receive the great gift of knowledge if you think you have some knowledge that others do not. So knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And if anyone thinks that he's got something and he's become somebody, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. So notice what Paul's doing here. They're so proud of their knowledge of God. And Paul's flipping that around and saying, what you should really be proud of is not your knowledge of God, but God's knowledge of you. What you want is not to know God, but for God to know you. That's the real critical question in life. Not do you know God, but does God know you? And not in that sense of God knows all things, but in the sense that God has claimed you. God knows you by name. You are God's people. You are one of God's people. That's the important question, not do you know God? And so how will you know if you are known by God? Paul says, not by all the great knowledge that you have, but because you love. Do you follow 1 Corinthians 13? Are you doing these things in relation to the brothers that he's describing over and over and over through this book? Do you have a love for Christ's church? Yes? Okay. You are known by God. You've got the right box checked. Now, knowledge helps in that area. Right? As we grow in knowledge, the Corinthians are needing to grow in knowledge. They have the wrong kind of knowledge. They need to know about how to treat the weaker brother. They need to know about what to do to spread the gospel. They need to know about love. They have the wrong kind of knowledge. They need to grow in knowledge, but the right kind of knowledge. A knowledge that is an ends, not a means. Knowledge is an end, is a means to the end of love. Love is the end to which knowledge should lead us. Knowledge should lead us to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. If it doesn't lead us there, it's of no value. That's the goal of the knowledge. So the critical question is, are you known by God? And you will know you are known by God if you love God and love his people. So then after kind of taking this little side trip into knowledge, he comes back to the topic at hand, the topic of eating food offered to idols. And again, he quotes their argument. So they say, now we all have this knowledge that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one God. So the basic point of the Corinthians yes group argument is, since that idol that the meat was sacrificed to is nothing, it's just wood or gold or stone, it has no existence. And so the person sacrificing the meat to the idol doesn't change the nature of the meat. The gold idol can do nothing to the meat. It's still just meat. And so since the idol is nothing, because there are no other gods, there is no God, the Greek gods are nothing. And so the fact that this meat has been sacrificed to idol has not changed the meat in any way. So your meat, whether it comes from Tyson's Food, the pagan temple, or the kosher deli, is all the same. It's just meat, right? And so you can eat any of that meat, says the yes group. And so Paul, He grants their argument without contradicting what he has said anywhere else about demons and idol worship. Let me make that clear. So for although there are many so-called gods in heaven and on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all things are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things and through whom are all things and through whom we exist. So he's granting their point. Yes, you're right. There's nothing to that idol. Now, elsewhere in Paul's writings, he does say that there are demons behind some of those idols, that demons are real and that the worship of demons is real. So is he contradicting himself here? And I would say, no, he says, you're right, there are the gods of this world, the other gods of this world are just so-called gods. And there are many gods and many lords and many demons, he might have said. Yet for us, there is one God and Father from whom all things and for whom we exist, from whom are all things and for whom we exist. So he's saying, in relation to God, even if there is a demon behind that idol, that demon has zippo power in comparison to our God. It's of no consequence in comparison to our God. And he cannot change the status of that meat for you. You should not be superstitious about that meat, as if that meat could bless you or curse you. So the meat would have power to bring blessing from the God. I sacrificed my lunch to the idol, and therefore now as I eat it, I receive the power from the idol. For the weak brother Christian, you fear cursing. You know, I'm eating this meat sacrificed to an idol and bringing this curse from the idol upon myself. Or maybe the weak Christian might still be thinking, you know, growing up in a pagan environment, might still be thinking, I shouldn't do this because I should seek my blessings from God and not from the idol. So in either way, the weaker brother has this superstition that something is happening to the meat, and Paul is fully granting the yes group's argument that the meat is not changed in any way. So then he moves on. So if it stopped there, the yes group would go, we win, right? We can do exactly what we've been doing, and the no group just needs to get in line. But Paul continues on. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as, I'll add a word here, as if really offered to an idol. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled. So you follow the argument there? Well, let me just keep going for a second. So food will not commend us to God, nor are we worse off when we do not eat, and no better off when we do. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, notice that phrase, see you eating in the idol's temple. So they're actually arguing not just that they could have this meat at home, but they could do it publicly in the idol's temple. If anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? So tying verse 10 back to verse 8, but some, through a former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Superstition dies slowly. Superstition in our lives dies slowly. It's a part of our sanctification. And here Paul is saying that these people who grew up in this environment, they're going to see you doing this thing, and they're going to be tempted to do it themselves, especially since you're probably leaders in the church. The yes group, the majority, the strong Christians, the one that knows the idol is nothing, is probably the leaders of the church. And so they're going to see you as the leaders of this church doing this thing, and they're going to go, okay, well, then I can do this thing. But when they do it, they're going to do it with this sense that the idol is doing something, whatever it is that they have that sense of. And as long as they have that sense of it as they're doing it, they are going to be defiling their conscience and therefore sinning against God. Everything, says Paul, must be done by faith, trusting that this is what God would have you to do. But the weaker brother is following your example, but he doesn't have the strength of your conviction. And so that superstition is convincing him that something is happening here. Something real is happening here. It's really being offered to an idol. It's really having an effect on the meat. It's really having an effect on the brother. And so in doing that, he has sinned, and you have caused him to sin by what you are doing. As an example, a couple of modern examples of this idea that our early teaching in life is hard to kill. I've known several Baptists in the course of my lifetime who have, in their early years, have been clearly taught that the drinking of all alcohol is wrong. Period. One sip is sinful. And then later in life, will come to the knowledge that, that's not what the Bible teaches. That drunkenness is forbidden in the Bible, but the drinking of alcohol is not forbidden. So their mind has come to this knowledge that it's okay, but they still can't bring themselves to actually do it because there's something in the heart that hasn't caught up with the knowledge of the mind. And I've seen this also in converted Jews who have come to the conclusion that there's nothing wrong with eating pork because now they're a Christian, and they realize that Christians eating meat is not going against the law of God and everything's fine, and yet they still can't bring themselves to actually eat a BLT. And so that sense of there's something wrong about what I'm doing, and as long as you have that sense of there's something wrong about what I'm doing, you better not be doing it. Because you have a weak conscience and your conscience is being defiled. And so in this case, we have people who've grown up as pagans and who really believe that the meat is affected. And so he's saying, don't eat the meat in front of them because you're going to cause them to do something that they ought not to do. Now, notice that Paul, again, is agreeing with the yes group. Food will not commend us to God, and we are no worse off if we do eat and no better off. I mean, we are not no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. He's saying, for your spiritual development, it really doesn't matter what you eat. Food does not make you spiritual. Refraining from food does not make you spiritual. So, just putting it in modern terms, because you're a carnivore or because you're a vegan, in and of itself, does not get you any closer to God, right? What you eat does not bring you closer to God. It's what Paul is teaching. Paul is also teaching that there is a freedom in Christ to be a carnivore or to be a vegan. There is a freedom in Christ to make these choices, and that God is not displeased by either of those two choices. God is not angered at the vegans in the church. God is not angered at the meat eaters in the church. We are free to make those decisions for ourselves. What we think is best, what we like, what we want. These are legitimate decisions. Now, I have gotten into trouble saying that sort of thing, standing up here in the past, because there is a group within the Christian church, both Reformed and unreformed, that believe that everything we do is a precise moral choice. So whether I had biscuits or toast or no bread at breakfast, if I didn't get the right choice, I sinned against God. There are those within our circles that would teach that sort of thing. And so just to keep myself from getting in trouble, I will quote Calvin, always the safe thing to do. Paul moves on to another question here, and he's talking about chapter 8 as a whole, which he had merely touched on in chapter 6 without developing it further. For when he had spoken about the greed of the Corinthians and had closed that part of his discussion in the chapter with the sentence, the covetous, extortioners, fornicators, etc., shall not inherit the kingdom of God, he had gone on from that to speak of Christian liberty. All things are lawful for me. Now we're going to explain, he's going to go on to explain that, Calvin is. But notice the context in which it comes. He's just said that the covetous, the extortioners, and the fornicators will not inherit the kingdom of God. So when he says, all things are lawful for me, he doesn't mean all things, right? He doesn't mean, oh, now you can be covetous. Now you can be an extortioner. Now you can be a fornicator. I actually had a Christian many years ago look at me and quote that verse as to the reason he could live with his girlfriend. Since all things are lawful, as long as I am living, you know, shacking up with my girlfriend in thanksgiving to God, it's okay because all things are lawful to me. I'm like, you missed the sentence before about fornicators. So what does Paul mean? How does Calvin understand what Paul means here, that all things are lawful for me? He says, Paul had taken the opportunity to pass from that to deal with fornication and from that to marriage, so that at last he follows up the passing reference he had made to in-between things, to bring out now how our freedom ought to be modified insofar as the in-between things are concerned. By in-between things, I mean things which are neither good nor bad in themselves, but neutral, and which God has given us power to use. Further, we ought to practice moderation in the use of them. So they're not good or bad in and of themselves. We have the power to use them, but we ought to practice moderation in using them so as to preserve the distinction between freedom and license. Okay, so let me apply Calvin here to our situation at hand, the eating of meat. So Paul is saying, you're no better off if you eat meat or if you don't eat meat. Spiritually, it is insignificant. As the word Dennis likes to use is adiaphora. It's nothing. It means nothing. There's no difference, no distinction between whether you eat meat or you don't eat meat. So Calvin qualifies that by saying we need to use it in moderation. Now, Paul's going to use that sort of reasoning to say, but you can't eat meat that causes your brother to sin. Now you've used your freedom immoderately. I think Calvin here has in mind my eating so much meat that I can't move. You know, the overabundance of food or the overabundance of drink, so that I am getting drunk or destroying my liver. So we are to use these things, and they do not have any effect on our spirituality, but the misuse of them can have an effect on our spirituality, is what Calvin is saying, and we'll see also in Paul. Okay, so coming back to the section we were in. So food will not condemn us to God, nor are we worse off if we eat or do not eat. Whether we're carnivores or vegans, we're spiritually, it's makes no difference. But take care that this right of yours to eat meat or be a vegan does not eat meat sacrificed to an idol or not sacrificed, does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who has knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat the food offered to idols? So, take care that you don't exercise your rights in such a way that you become a stumbling block to the weak. The thing to notice here, I'll mention it sort of in passing and then come back to it later, is the stumbling block is causing a fellow believer to sin. This passage is sometimes misused to say causing a fellow believer to think less of you. But that is not the case here. It is causing a fellow believer to stumble. You think of Mark 9:42, where Jesus says, you know, better to have a millstone tied around your neck than to cause one of the least of these to sin. So Paul's kind of having that same sort of argument here. Better to refrain from any of the good gifts that God has given you rather than causing one of your brothers to sin. Because if he sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed. Now, Paul doesn't go into any details about what this destruction means, but there, Paul does warn in numerous places to believers in the church to be careful about falling away, to be careful to make their calling and election sure, to work out their salvation with fear and trembling. And Paul's saying, if you contribute to this brother being destroyed, how could you in exercising something that is adiaphora? It doesn't matter whether you eat meat or not. And what really is bad is that in doing so, you sin against Christ. It's not just that you've done something bad to your brother, but because your brother is Christ and because your brother is his sins are paid for by the blood of Christ, you sin against Christ by eating that meat. So we've gone from the meat is insignificant to now you are sinning against Christ by eating the meat. Now, it's one step removed, obviously. It's not the meat itself. It's what you're doing publicly caused someone else to do. And so you have to be careful. And so Paul then goes on to say, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Now, just, you know, let that sink in for a second, right? I would rather, put it in modern terms. Here's what Paul's saying. I would rather not ever have a really juicy steak ever again than to cause my brother to sin. That's the level that Paul is calling us to. I would gladly give up, fill in the blank, if my not giving it up will cause my brother to sin. Whatever it is, I will give up any of my rights. And then you see Paul doing that in the very next chapter, right? The very next chapter is the one that Levi was talking about last week. And Paul was just rambling off the things that he, you know, had given up. He'd given up the right for a salary. He'd given up the right for a wife. He'd given up the right for a bed. You know, here's all the things that I have just voluntarily given up for the sake of my brother. And you won't give up a hamburger? So he's saying, I'd rather just never eat meat ever again than cause my brother to stumble. Now, I'm fully convinced that Paul continued to eat meat because there was meat not sacrificed to idols. And also, there was, he's talking about the public display, right? So he's not saying don't eat meat sacrificed to idols. He's basically saying don't let weaker brothers see you do it. So his argument, so when I said that the yes group was going into the temples and eating the meat sacrificed to idols, in the pagan festival, there was like this across the room when I said that, right? And our thought was, well, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't participate in pagan worship, right? You know, that's sinful to participate. Paul doesn't use that argument. Paul doesn't say, don't go to the temples and eat those feasts because, you know, you're worshiping some other god. He actually says, don't do it because somebody's going to see that and think it's okay to eat meat sacrificed to idols when they really know they shouldn't do it, when in their heart they feel like they shouldn't do it. So his argument wasn't the very argument that went straight to our heads. His argument was completely different. He was saying, He actually almost like grants their, he has granted the yes group's position and said, yeah, it would be fine to eat in the temple in the pagan sacrifice because that is nothing. There's nothing there. Nothing. There's nothing to see here, folks. There's no reality to what's going on. But don't do it because you will cause your brother to stumble. That's just a fascinating way to argue for this, and I think there's a lot more to think about in terms of that. So now, some misusage of this passage. This passage is often used, as I said, to teach not that we should be careful not to cause our brother to stumble, but rather we should not cause our brother to be offended. And there's a big difference between causing our brother to be offended and causing him to stumble. So just using the Baptist and the alcohol thing for a second. There is the Baptist who is absolutely convinced that this is wrong and would not take a drink of alcohol in order to save his physical life. Just dead set that this is wrong. And is offended that you do it and thinks that you are in sin. That's the one you do not have to worry about. The one you have to worry about is the one that's on the fence and is wrestling with the issue of whether alcohol is okay or not. And who might drink when they're not fully convinced that they're doing it in faith. That this is not something God would have them to do. That one you need to be very careful around. It's not the one who will be offended, but the one who will stumble, the one who will go against conscience, who will eat the meat when he sees you eating the meat, who will drink the alcohol when he sees you drinking the alcohol, but really isn't sure that that's the right thing to do. Who might be drinking it to fit in, who might be drinking it because he's trying to come around to this position, but he's still not there. He has it in his head, but not his heart. That's the one whom you will cause to stumble, causing the little one to sin. Better to have the millstone tied around the neck. Better to never drink alcohol again. Better to never have filet mignon ever again than to cause someone else to sin. So that's one misuse. trying to tell people you just can't offend anyone. The other misuse is those who take this to mean that we shouldn't use any of the good gifts that God has given us. I mean, Paul's clearly taught, don't go into the temple, you know, don't go publicly into the temple and eat meat sacrificed to idols because, you know, somebody's going to see you and then they're going to eat and they shouldn't be eating. So don't do that thing. And so it gets converted into don't do that thing, you know. So don't drink alcohol because there are alcoholics out there somewhere, you know. Don't have a beer with your friends in the backyard because in the state of Virginia there are alcoholics. That's not what Paul is saying. And so there are those who would want us to not use any of God's good gifts. Don't enjoy a vacation. Don't eat fancy meat. Don't do anything that's fun. If it's fun, don't do it because somebody's going to abuse it. Calvin goes so far as to say, you don't have to, in every choice you make, wonder if there's somebody possibly maybe watching that might stumble because they might see and might do and might. What he's teaching here, Calvin says, is the obvious. It's obvious that you have this yes group and this no group in your church. And if the no group sees you in the temple, they are going to stumble, and you need to be careful. So it's in those situations where you know there's this situation. And then also notice, and this will make us a little bit, I think it makes me a little uncomfortable. I think it would make all of us a little uncomfortable. Paul really here does have a distinction between the private and public use of the good gifts that God has given us. You know, if you're going to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, do it at home. You know, don't take that out. Don't get into the temple where you can be seen and might cause someone to stumble. Use those good gifts that you have been given in the privacy of your own home. And, you know, that makes us a little uncomfortable because we kind of sin that way, right? I sin in private. You know, I don't watch my pornography on the street, right? I watch my pornography in the bedroom on the little screen where no one will see me. You know, I sin in private and then have my tie on in public, right? And so we have this sense that if I'm doing something behind closed doors, it must be bad, right? And if I'm not willing to do it publicly, then that's really bad. Well, you know, I do take my clothes off behind closed doors. I will not be taking my clothes off here today as an example. Yeah. So there are things that are public and that we do in public. And why? Why is it okay for my wife to wear, you know, a sexy negligee for me in the private of our bedroom, but not wear it to church? Well, because she might cause my brother to stumble, right? That's the point. Well, let me change that. My wife would definitely cause some brothers to stumble. And so there is a public versus private use of the gifts. And Paul is making a very public statement here. Do not eat the meat sacrificed to idols in public. Don't go to the temple and let people see you doing this because it's going to cause somebody to sin. So, mask wearing. We have a yes group and a no group in this church. We have a yes group and a no group in this church, just like Corinth. Let's assume for a second that the no group is correct. Just hang with me, those of you in the yes group. Let's assume for a second that there is no point to wearing masks. And I know I'm running a little long, so I'm just going to use this one example. That social distancing and masking really make no significant difference. That either because the pandemic isn't as bad as the press and the government would have us believe, or because they really don't make a difference in the pandemic, and if we all just went on our life as normal, about the same number of people would get sick and die, and it's really just, there's no use. This is just a waste of time. It's causing, a social distance between us, literally a social distance. I always thought they should have called it physical distancing instead of social distancing, because, you know, I want to be physically distanced from you, but I certainly don't want to be socially distant from you. But it's causing social distance. It has this negative effect. So, you know, we have a yes group and a no group. What are we to do? Well, let's assume, again, that it really makes no difference. But there's this group in the church, in our church, that thinks it does make a difference, and that in not wearing a mask and in not social distancing, you're breaking the sixth commandment. You're endangering the lives of other people. I can't come to church. I can't come and worship because we're endangering the lives of people by sitting shoulder to shoulder and singing with our mask off and having only one service where we can just cram everybody in rather than separating it out to two services. I can't go. Well, so here is, you know, again, assuming. I'm taking the position of the masks are nothing. They mean nothing, like the idols. They mean nothing. They do nothing. And so I realize that my brother is going to refrain from worship because I refuse to wear a mask. He's not going to come. The Bible clearly says he has to come to worship. He has a duty to worship God in the presence of God's people. You know, and so here I am preventing my brother from worshiping because I won't wear a mask. If I have to wear a mask for the rest of my life, says Paul, if I have to put on a mask now and wear it every time I walk out of the house for the rest of my life, better that than to cause my brother to stumble. And so, as a session, we don't really need to know whether masks are work or not, and whether social distancing are work or not. We can look at all the data, and we can come to a conclusion, or we might come to a conclusion that we don't know. But in essence, it doesn't matter. As long as we have a yes group and a no group in the church, we need to do whatever we can for the weaker brother. Again, I'm assuming that masks don't work. We have to do whatever we can for the weaker brother to make them be able to come and to worship with the people of God. So, just blowing through the rest. Alcohol, we've already kind of talked about it. And whether it's an offense or a stumbling block and how to use it. It's worth thinking about Mormon worship, actual pagan worship. Could you attend or not? And why could you not? Or why could you? As well as Catholic masses. So the Catholic Mass says that Christ is there in the bread. It's a form of idolatry. This is Christ. And we believe that there are Christians in the Catholic Church. You know, I don't really know of anyone who says there are no Christians in the Catholic Church. Does my going encourage those Christians in the Catholic Church to continue to sin in their idolatry? Those are the kinds of questions that one has to ask when dealing with this sort of thing. Calvin, I'll wrap up with Calvin, on the question of Catholic Mass, which was a much more important question and relevant question in his day than in ours, just because of you only had two options, and they were right there in your face. I would simply advise my readers to compare Paul's day with ours and decide for themselves if it is permissible to be present at masses and other abominations, which are such a stumbling block to the weak. So, all right. I'm sorry I took us over. Thank you. You're dismissed.